You're very welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Week 2 of the Guinness Six Nations is in the books. Ireland are 2 wins out of 2 and 2 bonus points out of 2 as well after their 11th victory in a row against Scotland, 32-18 at Murrayfield on Sunday. Simon Easterby's side, now the only team to have a shot at a Grand Slam. That's after England's win against France on Saturday evening. We'll touch on that a little bit later on. A late Elliot Daly try gave England a much-needed lift there. And before all of that in Rome, Italy beat Wales for the second year in a row, 22-15, a scoreline that flatters Wales, 14 defeats in a row for them now, dating back to the 2023 Rugby World Cup. Strong odds as well that that losing run is probably going to go out to 17 games, given what they have between now and the end of the campaign. No matches this weekend in the Six Nations, so the first break week of the Championship is upon us. And that is probably why the Welsh Rugby Union have decided to act. They've parted company with Warren Gatland. Cardiff head coach Matt Sherratt is going to be in temporary charge for the rest of the Championship, and they'll look to appoint a permanent successor then before their summer tour of Japan. Bernard Jackman and Johnny Murphy are with me today. And guys, I think we should probably start with that big news from Wales yesterday. Just to sum up the mess that Wales have found themselves in, it's 11 months and 8 consecutive defeats since Warren Gatland offered his resignation to the Welsh Rugby Union last year. Now they've finally decided to take him up on his offer, 8 defeats in a row later. Like, it's no real surprise, is it?
No, it's not. It was coming, and I think probably the timing of it, I think all of us assumed, or certainly the Welsh journalists assumed, it would happen at the end of the Six Nations. But I also think, from Gatland's point of view, if he feels he can't move them any further or turn this around, you know, it's become very negative and toxic in Wales for him and for Welsh rugby in general. I mean, it's always been quite toxic. Even when they were winning, they weren't happy. But at the moment, it's just pretty horrible. And the Italian game, there was nothing really there you could take from it if you're a Welsh coach. So he said, you know, Gatland's been, you know, very much in praise of his players for how hard they're working. But unfortunately, nothing is really transferring to the pitch at the moment, and the next 3 games could be bleak. So he's offered his resignation. Abby Tierney, the CEO, has been clear that there's no payout, that he's actually started to walk away, and must be very tough for him, because he came back believing he could bring back former glories. But the Welsh rugby talent pool now, compared to the one he had, you know, it's chalk and cheese. And Matt Sherratt, it's interesting. I mean, Matt Sherratt is coming in as caretaker coach. He's going to double job with Cardiff for the last 3 games. He's been clear he doesn't want the job. He says that he wants to concentrate on Cardiff. So there'll be a worldwide search now for a successor. But look, unless they pay astronomical wages, I don't think it's that attractive a job. But there will be coaches who will want to take it on. But I think certainly the landscape, there won't be 600,000 a year, again, that Warren was on. But yeah, it's a tough times. But look, Dave, you reap what you sow. I mean, there's been years and years of underinvestment, mismanagement, and they're oblivious to it. Very poor leadership at the top of the WRU, for sure. But it's obviously easier point a finger at the head coach.
But, and where do they go, Bert? Like, how do they restart it? They don't necessarily have, you know, everyone talks about our private schools. England also have a fairly healthy private school system. Their structure is probably not as much aligned as ours, in terms of, you know, they don't have one centralised competition in areas. But where do they go? Like, if they were a business, they would have folded years ago. Mm. So how do they generate that? And is it someone, you know, a young aspiring coach that has, you know, credentials in the club game, they say, right, I will need a 4 or 5 year deal here to try and come in? Or do they look at a kind of a director of rugby in that sense and try and cut it from the ground up and start all over again?
Look, off the record, I was told that there was a split in the kind of senior management, the people who were looking to recruit Gatland's replacement, because they probably knew they were going to have to replace him. You know, it was probably this summer he was going to go anyway. And it's the problem is some of that group feel it's a young, ambitious coach, you know, who will bring energy, will bring new ideas, will bring the squad together. is what's needed, and others feel they need a marquee coach, a superstar coach, a Warren Gatland, a Joe Schmidt, Eddie Jones, less so, but that type of Jake White, someone who's got unbelievable history and legacy in the game. And I don't know which one would work. I mean, a young coach, could a young coach handle that negativity and pressure, and to lose 80% of your games, which I think they probably will for a while. They will obviously. They can get to the stage where they can pick up some wins, but and this summer to go to Japan, they could certainly get a win there. But until things change a little bit, the interesting thing for Matt Sherratt is effectively he's starting Monday morning, so he's got 7 days. Sorry, he's not got 7 days. He's got five days prep and to play Ireland. They're still not sure what his assistant coaching staff are like. Is Who's coaching the team next week? Matt Sherratt, his background is attack, backs and attack. He's a hands-on coach. He's a tracksuit coach. So you would believe that Rob Howley's the one in the firing line. They've already got sacked Alex King. He moved on before the Six Nations as part of that, I suppose, action
2017.
to the player review in November. Their attack has looked terrible. Against France, it was so deep behind the game line, they never really asked any questions. And then against Italy, they obviously had a kicking game they wanted to impose, but they didn't really show anything attack. So I imagine Rob Howley would probably step down on Monday, and Matt Sherratt will come in and focus on the attack. And they will get a bounce. They'll probably get a bounce this week against Ireland. Like it's bad timing for Ireland's point of view because there's going to be that emotional charge. Matt Sherratt's a good coach. He's very popular. A lot of these players would have worked with him either in the Ospreys or in Cardiff or the little bits he's done with Wales before. And there'll be a change of mood, but based on what we've seen, Ireland would have to underperform, you would think, for our Wales would have to step up massively for us to lose that game. And it's they don't have the money to put into the regions. They're fighting over a new regional agreement. They know they should go to three, but they don't have the balls to do it. It's a real shit show.
Like to follow on what you said there a couple of minutes ago, you obviously said like they will get some level of a bounce from Matt Sherratt and from whoever probably comes in the summer. Just that the good feeling coming back in, but it's only going to be a bounce to an extent, you'd imagine. Like they probably are at rock bottom now in terms of where they're going to fall, but the issue probably is still that they're probably going to stay there or thereabouts around this rock bottom for a few years. There isn't a there isn't a situation, I don't think, where you get someone in Wales all of a sudden are back up amongst a top three team in the Six Nations, or they're picking off big wins against other tier one opposition over the next couple of years. And that probably leads you to you're talking about the potential candidates to come in this summer. It's not so much like who are the names out there, because this is actually a summer where there are some decent names out there. You mentioned Joe Schmidt as one, Stuart Lancaster is available, Michael Sheck is available. There's talk of Franco Smith potentially getting a little kind of getting interested in other gigs away from Scotland. But the issue isn't really who is available. It's who would want the job.
Look, it's a tough job. They will get, like, you're paying 350, 400, you'll get those guys who are a Czechia, for example. I would imagine, I'm only guessing here, but like he's been in international rugby most of his last 10 years. Obviously, he's doing some stuff in Japan. He would never back away from a challenge. He would.
And
He
this is a
was.
bloody big challenge.
No, I know, but that's his. Like he, I think he's nearly better with a challenge. Like he would revel in it. Franco Smith, I think, is in line to be the next Scottish coach, so he might hold out for that.
Well,
Liam McDonald.
sorry to interrupt. That is actually something I was considering yesterday. If you are one of these names that out there who would be looking to get back into international management, I think you might actually be holding off and trying to see what happens in Scotland over the next 12 months.
Yeah,
Because
no, it's a better job.
David Nussafora has high standards. I could potentially see him get just growing a little bit impatient with the way things are going in Scotland.
Yeah, no, 100%, 100%, Neil. I think there's going to be other jobs that come up. Liam McDonald apparently was interviewed for Munster. That's the rumor. And I know he's actively looking to get back into coaching. He's been potentially linked to Australia as well. They will get a coach. That coach will want to bring his own team in, and whoever they get, I think, will insist that they have a say over what happens underneath, or else they're at a lost cause. You know, they need to be able to get stuck into the regional rugby, get stuck into the pathways,
Is that why they
and
need a, do they need like a David Nusa Four or rather, you
yeah, they've
know, as
no,
well?
yeah, so. The director of rugby at the moment is an interim director of rugby or high performance manager, a fellow called Hugh Bevan, who I worked with in the Dragons. His background would be S&C, because Nigel Walker left, Nigel Walker left. I'm not sure how that unfolded, but Hugh Bevan has stepped up as interim. Again, like, he's a good fella, but his experience wouldn't be anything like what's needed there. You know, he worked with S&C with English cricket, very good in that area. Worked with S&C in America, with the Eagles. But yeah, this is a you probably need someone very experienced who can actually communicate both ways, communicate up to the committee in the WRU, but also communicate with the stakeholders in the regions, and also the club game over there, which is on its knees, really. You know, so it's a huge job.
We'll start the Bernard Jackman high
No,
performance.
they have enough of me over there. Yeah, it's you're nearly a rugby CV. Better off having maybe a peacekeeping CV background, because it's going to take a huge amount of flexibility and compromise from a lot of people to even start this back. And that's not being disrespectful to the current playing group. Like, they're putting everything in. I actually thought they were very brave against France, and they put a huge amount of effort in against Italy, but it just looked like a team like with
Who's lost?
confidence levels on the floor. And again, like, I think for Matt Sherratt and Ireland are probably the worst opponent you want next time up, you know, your first job, because we are quite consistent and we're quite robust mentally. Whereas you would say if they played Scotland or even France at home, you know, there's more of a chance of an upset. Now, obviously, there's always a chance of an upset, but you would think Ireland are the team that match are at of the five other opponents. They're the ones you would least like to play first up, I would think.
While we're still talking about contenders, obviously in Wales in particular, people have thrown Simon Easterby's name into the mix as someone they would love, and you can obviously see why based on these first couple of games with the way he's taken things on from Andy Farrell. Could you possibly see Simon Easterby being interested in that, even as someone who is living and is based in Wales and you know as Welsh as the Welsh family and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah,
Shaking of the head, I see.
I would be absolutely shocked if he wanted to go into that. I mean, if you're a part of that Irish setup, and Simon knows how difficult Wales is, obviously from his time, well, his whole career playing there, but also his time as coach of Scarlets. And I actually think it's got worse for the regional head coaches since then, and that does affect the head coach of the national team. So absolutely, he should be on any shortlist. But I personally would be shocked. I think the commute is manageable for international rugby. You know, he's working with brilliant players, he's getting a taste now of being head coach. You would say if this season goes the way we hope it'll go, you know, he'll put his hand up to be the successor to Andy Farrell eventually. So I didn't think there was a runner really, but that's just I that's my I absolutely should be on my shortest, but I wouldn't think it would be a job that would be attractive to him.
I think it spoke volumes to the situation they're in, where I do remember it was a few weeks or maybe a couple of months ago when Ron Nogaro was asked by a Welsh journalist if he would have any interest in taking on that job. And you know, Ron Nogaro is a smart man. If he thinks there's a way he can kind of maneuver one thing and you know maneuver a bit of job interest somewhere else, he'd be all for it. And even he said just kind of gave a straight up no to it. But moving on, I suppose the last point on this, Johnny. It is sad to see a legacy like Warren Gatland's now so tainted at Wales. You know, he's the guy that came in firefighting in 2007 from a complete mess of a situation and delivered three Grand Slams, got them to two World Cup semi-finals. You know, led this golden generation and this incredible time of Welsh rugby, and to come back and win 6 out of 25 games. To go from a record 14-game winning streak in his first period in charge to 14 consecutive defeats to bookend it all. It is just sad to see, I suppose, from a coaching point of view, and someone with such a huge name in the world game.
Yeah, I suppose it is, but you have to remember why he took it. He took it because he thought he could really make a difference, and he did offer to kind of fall on his sword a couple of times up until now. But his legacy will always stand in terms of what he has done for Welsh rugby. It depends on, when all of this settles down and you look back, he'll always be remembered of that as that high class coach. And, your legacy is what people. It's the sense of perception sometimes, but the reality is he did all of that first time around. And also the reality is, yes, okay, he was paid very well, but at the same time he went in because he wanted to, he knew what trouble they were in and he was trying to actively turn it around. So yeah, it is, it's a double-edged sword there for him, but he will always be one of, if not the most successful, Welsh coaches, but it'll also be remembered for what was the last 14 games as well, unfortunately. So I think you just have to have a bit of context in terms of what he came back to and also the context of why he took the job. And when it all settles down, he will hopefully be remembered for all the good times he gave Welsh rugby.
Bernard, I am interested actually to see, does he put himself out there for one more big gig to try and rectify things a little bit?
Yeah,
Like
I
this would be a
would.
very sour note for
Yeah,
such a
I think
long
if
career to end in.
he may just say, look, that's enough, and I know he's got his nice holiday home in Waikato and New Zealand, and if he was to go anywhere, I would guess Japan, but just because of the proximity to get some more family balance in and out of Japan a little bit if he wants to just keep his eye in, but I think. Financially, the game has been good to him, and maybe now it's time to retire. He is a very competitive guy, though, and yeah, you're right. Maybe he wants to, show he still has it. But I would imagine it'll be in Japan with the likes of Robbie Deans and Steve Hansen and so many of those other coaches who have tasted international rugby and are now working in the club game over there.
Let's pivot it on to Ireland then. That's who Wales are playing next in Cardiff, Saturday, 22nd of February. You obviously alluded to it, Bernard, that while Wales are likely to get a bounce of some description under Matt Charette, the complacency really is probably the only thing stopping Ireland going ahead and getting that win next weekend. If you were to judge it off the game against Scotland, no signs of complacency whatsoever. At Murrayfield on Sunday, they went in with the attitude absolutely spot on from the first minute.
Yeah, and that's probably the most impressive thing about Ireland over the last 7 or 8 years is that level of consistency, and not letting complacency get inside their psyche at all. Now, probably an easier build up for Scotland because they've had some good results, but Ireland were nearly picture perfect in that first period when they blew Scotland away. So that would give you comfort, and I think two bonus point wins gives them lots of confidence going to Cardiff. But still, it's still a rugby match. You saw France against England. I mean, England are obviously a better side than Wales, but if you don't take your chances and a little bit of doubt slips in and there's errors, you can get caught. So this is still a match that has to be won. But on evidence, you can't. It's very hard to find reasons why Ireland would slip up. If you get me. Whereas against Scotland, there was reasons. Last game was close. They have X factor players like Finn, Darcy Graham, etc. Whereas with Wales at the moment, I'm not saying they don't have players, but they don't have players that probably are showing a lot of reason. So I think Ireland would take them absolutely seriously, but you'll be very disappointed if this was a game that messed up our championship.
And Johnny, like staying on that point of the overall attitude around Ireland at the moment, they seem to have kind of there has been a bit of an edge to them over the last couple of games. I do wonder, have they felt coming into this tournament that they're being a little bit undervalued, a little bit underappreciated with the, there was plenty of criticism after the November games where they weren't really at their highest level. Then you have the whole Andy Farrell situation going away with the Lions, and people were questioning how they'd react to that. Then throw in on top of that as well, it's a Lions year as well. And I don't know, from my point of view, listening to plenty of podcasts that are coming from the other side of the Irish Sea, there's a lot of talk about this incredible Scottish backline that's going to be eating up places on a Lions tour, how good England are, how much they're improving, and how many Lions places they're going to be taking up. Do you think there's a sense in the wider group of the Irish squad, or even just with individuals, that maybe for a team going for three Six Nations titles in a row, they might not be being appreciated too much outside of Ireland?
I'm not sure about that. I do think that they're kind of just laser focused on what the task is in hand, and they take it kind of game by game. The white noise around that, even, Stephen Ferris and those, guys building up the fact that there is that kind of the Peter O'Mahony factor last week, the booing. There is just a bit of an edge to that rivalry. But like, Ireland are way ahead in that rivalry in terms of that. I do think it's probably media led in terms of that, to try and build Ireland up. There's a big focus, even like someone we would know quite well, Jim Hamilton, even during the week in his podcast, he, keeps coming back to the quarterfinals and the big games, and Ireland messed up, last year after being 8 points up and all of that kind of stuff. But like, the reality is they've won the last two Six Nations and they're odds on to win three in a row. But I don't think they let that get in. I think it's just a media led thing, and if it gives them a small bit of extra drive, it gives them a small bit of extra drive. But I don't think it's something that they'd be talking about, or that is within the group, because the facts are the facts, and they seem to be just laser focused on game by game and building every single week, as cliched as it sounds, and all the interviews, but that's obviously just what their focus is, and what their mental strength allows them to just concentrate on that.
First, Jim Hamilton played his role as the secret agent very, very well over the last couple of weeks, I think, did
Yeah, he did great, didn't he?
he?
I think it was good to have him on a different perspective.
No, he was great.
I spoke to him after the match, and he's gutted by it. They all are. I did corporate boxes before and after the game, and I've done lots of them in the Viva as well, after losses too. But I've never seen, fans more dejected than the Scottish War, or ex-players, so like Sir Hugo Southwell, Johnny Beattie, Ryan Wilson, Craig Chalmers, David Denton. They were just broken. Like they just seen this picture so many times against Ireland, and it was kind of the worst defeats have been in World Cups, but it was kind of felt like a World Cup defeat, where they just didn't, like, if you're a Scotland, if you're Gregor Townsend Monday morning, and you're trying to pick bits from that game. I mean, it's very hard to find enough examples where you'd say, look, if we played them next week, we'd win, and that's how dominated they were. I know they had excuses, but I felt that first in terms of an injury, and that was cruel to go 6-2 and lose two backs. But I felt the first week,
Ireland were comfortably on top at that stage.
100%. Like, even with Finn, I felt they didn't have they hadn't found a different way of playing that was going to change the result. So now they could bounce back and beat England. They've obviously had a hex over them, but but there's a massive mental issue with them. It looked like they had no belief that they could beat Ireland. And that's a great thing if you have that in your locker, that you're so dominant over an opponent that they have to, pull something dramatic out to beat you and change that. So, from Ireland, they did it again. They quelled that belief brilliantly, and it was a very good performance by Ireland. Very, very professional, very efficient, and yeah, it gives you a lot of confidence, doesn't it?
It really does. And particularly around Sam Prendergast, Johnny, 22 years of age today. Happy birthday to him. But we were coming in last week saying, obviously, this was a big week for him. It was his first test match outside of Ireland. And ultimately it probably ended up being his best performance out of his five in a green shirt. He was outstanding and looked so comfortable in an away game. Granted, obviously, like, the forwards gave him an armchair ride, but he pulled off some brilliant things, lovely passes, nice kicking when he needed to as well.
Yeah, I think he probably learned from the first day in terms of his kicking wasn't probably on where he wanted it to be first time up against England. And he concentrated on that. And, you know, bar one kick, it was kind of bang on the money in terms of his contestables, his exits. And he had the confidence to kind of step inside and get himself extra time to get those kicks away. But yeah, he's kind of just, you know, the exuberance of youth. He's just really enjoying himself, it seems to be. Like you see in the and without being too simplistic, he looks like he's having a lot of fun, you know, and that comes down to all the experience around him, having one of the best nines in the world, who probably for me probably was man of the match on Saturday. But obviously there's the whole Sam factor that people kind of just get drawn to him when he does play well, in terms of that, you know, that accolade. But yeah, he's having fun, he's very confident, and he's seeing a lot of space. It's all happening quite, but you know, there's a lot of people that are creating that for him and that are helping him out. And then don't underestimate the amount of work that he's doing off pitch outside to try and to see that space and analyze teams. And yeah, but he's been excellent. And I think a big thing was, one, the confidence for that he would get out of, you know, what Jack Crowley brought against England. And there was a question whether he was going to start or not, you know, in the media, probably not within camp. The confidence that he would have got from being given that opportunity again, and then delivering, and then also the bounce he's going to get when the decision is made, when Crowley comes on, that he stays on the pitch and Crowley goes to 15. Like all those little things really, really matter in the development of a younger player, and the confidence that they can grasp from that. So yeah, he's going really well, and long may that continue for Ireland.
Bernard.
Yeah, same. I thought the way he figured out the how to manage the pressure England put on him previous week in terms of getting to his kicking game, how accurate he was in that, obviously, how he found grass on a couple of occasions, the way he didn't overplay, you know, early doors and just put contestables up. He hasn't look at the thing is, Johnny knows this. I only know it a little bit, but he has the mentality for this. You know, he has the mentality for this, and that's the key differentiator between a world class 10 in time and a talented 10. You know, there's lots of talented 10s who come along, and Sam has talent, but the best talent he has, I think, is his mental strength and his calmness and his ability to take on information. I think. Spoke to someone who's been coaching in Ireland for the last couple of weeks, and they said, "Just tell him something once. Just tell him something once, and you can take it that he understands it." You know, and that's not a given either. That's not a given either. So, yeah, I thought it was perfect actually in terms of his development to have a couple of moments against England which didn't go well, and then come back the week after and away from home and look really composed and being really accurate. That's brilliant as you want. He's going to have ups and downs, you know, as all tens do. But I think the difference is, Neil, and this is maybe what some of the people who didn't see what Farrell saw or Simon sees, is he does have an ability to help us play with more wit, and we're seeing that. We're seeing that. We saw it against England. We saw it against Scotland. So. And I said it against Ed. He may not. He is an amazing passer, and he probably is a little bit better passer than most of their tens he's competing with. But I think what differentiates him is his willingness to go there when he thinks it's on, and accept that sometimes he's going to get the wrong call. You know, so like I know Ireland are more powerful than Scotland, but for Ireland to be able to beat the bigger teams, I think. We can't always rely on ground and pound. I think we have to pull that trigger to get into the wider spaces a little bit earlier. And I think Sam, that's one area that he definitely has in his favour is he wants to play with wit, and he can play with more so than maybe some of the other competitors.
And
What
I
do you
think
think?
that's really important in terms of the setup for both Leinster and Ireland, that they hold at least one, if not two guys in those 15s, be it one back, one forward, predominantly a forward in that space, that you have to, you're not just doing that to kind of to try and, I suppose, lengthen the defensive line and get easy carries. You're doing it that when they tighten up, that you can go there and that you can take that space. So it's an added layer and an added extra strength to any attacking team if you have a 10 that's willing to take that chance sometimes when there's shooters. Like there was one incident where they had a small bit, they had a, I think, knock-on advantage, but I know it's a good time to go, but he kicked across the field, didn't work. But sometimes the referee can go advantage over the minute the ball touches a foot.
And
So,
Scotland were angry that the referee didn't on
yeah,
that occasion, yeah.
but like that's what he does. And if it didn't come off, it didn't come off. But if it got, if the advantage was called over, he'd just watch that and move on. That's his kind of superpower. So, but it is that, I think within the framework that both Leinster and Ireland have, it's the ability to pull the trigger and actually add that as a layer of strength to Ireland and not just use it as a layer for to give you easier carries in the middle in between the two 15s because you're lengthening the defensive line.
One of the things that stood out, like we spoke last week about how the attack was starting to layer on and layer on a little bit more, and I think we saw some more of that as well, some nice tries. But like Bernard, one thing that just jumps out is it's the sheer work rate. You first half there were at least three Scottish kicks charged down. You have Calvin Nash essentially kind of milking, not milking, like, it was a fair yellow card, but Duane van der Merwe getting a yellow card because Calvin Nash just would not give up on a potential lost cause. Then the third try of the game for James Lowe comes from that 5 meter scrum, which Ireland earned because Jameson Gibson-Park puts that chip in over the top, and you've himself and probably two other players just swarming on Blair Kinghorn. They absolutely smother them at times. And like, it does really, it shows up that, like, you can have the lovely wide passes from the likes of a Sam Prendergast as well, but that all has to marry up with just the bloody mindedness and the sheer hard work.
No, 100%. And I think we are better defensively than we have been. I think it's a more aggressive defense. It's not kamikaze blitz, but in around the contact area, Ireland are, working incredibly hard, and they're making the opposition work really hard for every single breakdown to not just recycle the ball, not just have quick ball, but actually recycle it to be able to win it. And you see a balance and mix between, counter rucking, just fanning out, jackal threats, choke tackles. It's the full repertoire Ireland can bring. And the odd time they do send shooters, but you mentioned there, they now actively get to the foot of the opposition, and we got three blockdowns. But even when we're not getting blockdowns, we're making teams kick badly to us. And then that's opened up more opportunities, and like England did to us in the first half. We don't have a exclusivity on that, but I think there's more of an edge to our D. And I think that's why we made Scotland look so poor, really, because just the work rate made it very hard for Scotland to get any numerical advantage, and they were just facing a wall all the time.
You could see it, Johnny, like particularly in that first half as well, where because Ireland had got a couple of those blockdowns, there ended up being some rush clearances. Finn Russell had a couple of them early on before he went off as well, that, barely got outside the 22. But that's just coming from the pressure and the rush that Ireland are putting them under.
Yeah, and I do think that I wouldn't underestimate kind of what Paul O'Connell brings in that. That was one of the biggest things of playing with him that he always had was be the best at, be world class at all the talentless tasks. So stuff that requires zero talent, getting up off the ground quicker, beating your opposite man, winning foot races. Diving at feet when you have such talent as Ireland do, and they're so well coached. If you have that just sheer mentality that I'm going to be better at someone and quicker up off the ground, and better at every single thing that requires zero talent, your talent will win eventually. So I do think that they're just on that, and that is just a single-mindedness to just be. Next job mentality in that I'm going to make sure I look after my role as best as possible. Again, it's all very cliched, all very simplistic, but it really, really makes a huge difference. And I do think we've spoken about this before, the D and their work at the breakdown, I do think there is a bit of a name bar effect in that, that, you know, the Leinster guys, and that's a massive part of their D system, is post-tackle contact work. The ability to slow it down, allow your line loosen and bring more line speed. That is something that is overflowing into the national side, and you can see that now. And it's added an extra, we talk about extra layers in attack. It's added an extra layer defensively to this Six Nations.
Looking at the game against Wales, possible changes or things that Easterby might like to switch up. Bear in mind, solid chance you have Tadhg Furlong, Joe McCarthy back available, Mack Hansen available again after being a late withdrawal from the game against Scotland. You also have the A game as well. The Ireland A is taking on England A in Bristol the day after Ireland-Wales as well. And Bernard, you have to factor in as well, if you rest one of the big names for next week against Wales, it does mean they're going into the game against France 2 weeks later without having had a match for 4 weeks. So while there's temptation to rejig things a little, you do have to be a little bit wary as well. And that A game does probably give you the opportunity to take less chances, yeah, or take less risks against Wales in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah, it's perfectly timed, isn't it, really, from an overall squad management point of view. You can get some players to play URC this week if you want, some of the fringe players, and then obviously you have that A game, and a nice young Irish coaching staff with Mark Sexton working underneath Prendy and Sean O'Brien and Jimmy Duffy together as part of that. So, and they've all been in camp and, you know, making sure that they know kind of what the core beliefs are of Simon Easterby and Paul O'Connell, etc. So should have some consistency there. I wouldn't be surprised if Jack starts. I think, I don't think it's going to be wide-scale changes, but I think certainly the bench could, you know, could start. Like Jack Conan deserves to start now, you know. Does Baird get a start? Is it a game for Izuchukwu? I know he's someone outside of 23, but is it a game where you get a little look at him? Dan Sheen probably starts. Ronan Kelleher goes to the bench. So I think that's what we're going to see, rather than, you know, four or five players taken in from outside of 23. And then obviously it means you can control their game time, so that they're not going 3 weeks without a match. So, yeah, I think that some of the bench will get an opportunity to start. But with those two gap weeks in the Six Nations that is there now, you kind of can go the same squad for five games, you know. There's no need to rotate too much. But I also think in terms of squad morale and competition, our bench has been so good that they deserve a chance.
Yeah, and Johnny, I think it's probably a case of who you're playing in that third week as well. I think if, for example, if Ireland were playing France next weekend with the week off either side of it, and maybe Wales in round four, you might be more inclined to go all out against France and then maybe rest players against Wales the following time out. But like, what about, for example, like Tadhg Furlong coming back in, for example, would you be inclined to start him, or would you kind of keep him on the bench and, in fairness, reward Finlay Beelan with another start after he's been excellent for two games?
I'd probably, with someone like Furlong, I'd probably go potentially 20 minutes off the bench or play him in the A game in a full 80. For me, I don't see, I think potentially maybe only three, four changes max, but all bench players. So probably change the centre pairing again.
And sorry, when you say like the bench players, when you're talking about those players who would have been, you know, 16 to 23 last weekend, the players dropping out, are you just keeping them on the bench against Wales as well?
Yes.
Or are you giving them the week off altogether?
No, I'd keep them involved. So you'd probably change. The one would be Hooker, Conan, and then, you know, change around the centre pairing, and then potentially, you know, one other based on what Mack Hansen or where he's at, because he was still named. So you would imagine that it could be a situation where he was named and then pulled out late, that he wasn't that far off. So they would potentially go back to the original starting team. You know, like he could have got a knock at some stage. So I don't see there being massive changes. It would probably be Furlong in all likelihood, probably Furlong coming onto the bench, and then Clarkson potentially playing the A game. But I don't see a whole lot. I would see three or four max, but I do think Conan, Kelleher, and the centres are probably the three. Ringrose coming back in and then managing there, given the three quality centres we have, that would be it. I think the likes of Jamie Osborne and those guys, I think you would see a proper potential full strength Ireland A side, if you get what I mean. So everyone outside of the match day 25 or 26 that warm up, playing in that game against Bristol, and you would imagine England would potentially do the same. So that's going to be a real, real high quality game with, the likes of Osborne and other guys who are in that. You could even see potentially Calvin Nash not potentially being on the bench and playing in that. You would manage that as best as possible. But I don't see wholesale changes, three or four max for me.
Yeah, and like it might be an unpopular decision not to make too many changes for that game against Wales. But in fairness, like as Johnny was just listening out there, Bernard, like there's the potential for this game against England A to be a really, really high quality game. And you expect England A to be a pretty decent side as well.
Yeah, no, I think it's gonna be great. It's great to see how they. I love the A fixtures.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've been starved of them. Over the last 5 or 6 years, only getting the odd game in. But I think it's a great chance to see them how they come together in a, I suppose a put together side, have a week prep, and go play against another opposition who should be, a real test for them. Yeah, and it's definitely a chance for them to put their hand up again. I know. The Emerging Ireland was a chance to over the last two years for them to get some time with Irish coaches, and the Irish coaches, senior coaches won't be involved in this, but it's still something they'll be very, very interested in how they perform, how they step up, and how they integrate. So big opportunity for the next crop. People criticise Ireland a little bit for being quite static in their selection, but it's proven to be a smart strategy in terms of getting wins, but there's always a need to see who's next in, and this A game is perfect for that.
Yeah, I'm
I
really
just
looking
hope that it's one more step towards bringing back the Churchill Stags. They were the best crack
forward.
ever, of course. I definitely throw my name in the hat for that coaching ticket anyway, that'll be sure.
I think, do you know what, Johnny? You need to lead the charge in this. I think there'll be a great book written about the Churchill Cup days.
No, never, never to be published. We were actually talking about it at the Legends game, the England week. They were unbelievable. At one stage, I think there was lads actually saying to Decky, saying, "Oh no, I don't want to go to Argentina. I think I'd be much better, real senior lads. I think I'd be much better bringing a crew of young lads over to America, making sure they understand what it's like to play for Ireland." So, yeah, they were good fun.
I'm sure they were. Right, we'll wrap it up with France and England, because France's Grand Slam hopes are gone, beaten 26-25 against England in a wild game, I think it's fair to say. I'm wary of being disrespectful to England here, Bernard, just because like they did have to go out and ultimately win it and come from behind, and they managed their way through the game excellently. But at times, the attitude of that French team absolutely stunk, I thought.
It was weird because normally that England game, the crunch, is a game that they've got up for. And they did get up for it. They created so many opportunities. It was bizarre that you had some of the most talented players in the world, some of the players who can score tries from nothing, and they botched, four or five easy try scoring opportunities. And then it just set in. I think if you're Fabien Galthié at half time, you still think we're going to win this match. I mean, you weren't panicking as such. And even with 5 minutes to go, you still think you have the game won. But he got caught, and that's the lesson that they have to learn. Very frustrating. Actually, this week there's been a huge amount of pressure on Galthié in the
Yeah.
French media. A lot of people felt he should have died in the sword after the World Cup exit. But I think we'll see how the championship ends for them. But I certainly think that he's done a pretty decent job with his French team in terms of getting some consistency, better discipline. Now I know discipline discipline was poor against England, but that's probably just I don't know what happened to them, because certainly the way they played against Wales, the way their players have been playing for their clubs, that performance was miles off. And it'll be really interesting how they bounce back, because I still believe they're a genuine threat to Ireland, like
Oh, yeah.
genuine. And would be harder beat now because they've no joker card to play. So that was a bad result for Ireland, I think. But it's still a test for them, and can they bounce back and get some confidence back, because their confidence will be dented.
Yeah, well, I think it probably definitely is a bad result for Ireland in another way because England ended up getting that bonus point. And based on the bonus point they got against Ireland, which Ireland really shouldn't have let them get, they're now really live contenders if Ireland don't beat France to. If Ireland don't win a Grand Slam, all of a sudden they've got England right over their shoulders. Johnny, I'm curious though, like, we didn't see performances like this from France pretty much right up to the Rugby World Cup in 2023. Is there a sense that there still is that bit of a World Cup hangover over them, where they put so much into that tournament, you know, in their own country and all that sort of stuff, that they've struggled a little bit to motivate themselves since then?
Yeah, I
Because
do
we
think,
they're kind of back to that old France of you don't know what you're going to get on a given day. And I actually do feel comfortable kind of being hypercritical of them because I'm pretty confident when they do come to Dublin in a few weeks' time, they're probably going to put in one of their better performances.
they do have those performances, like the Italy performance last year where they should have lost, with that kick at the end. They have performances like this in them, and you're probably correct. It just hasn't clicked fully, you know, and like last year, Ireland first up, like they demolished them early doors and they just couldn't grasp back momentum then in the game. It was just the amount of, and Bert said, the amount of unforced errors, but like they have an absolutely class team, but there is a bit of negativity with it, you know, all the issue with around Jalibert and all of that. And it's a bit French in terms of the attitude thing that has just kind of seeped in post World Cup. And it must have been a massive deflation in terms of that quarterfinal exit, probably even most more so than Ireland in terms of what was. And but like it's coming up to 2 years ago now, like they need to try and move on mentally from it. And you know, is that a change of management at the end? Potentially, but it all depends on how they bounce back, particularly get next weekend, but more importantly, how what they do and if they show up to Dublin. I think that's going to be probably the mark of where they are as a group. And if they put in a performance like they can, then that's going to be an absolute belter of a game.
Yeah, it is like, but it just is remarkable, Birch. Like you look at what they have and how focused they were over those few years leading up to the World Cup. It's incredible to think under Galtier, this incredible group of players as well have only actually won one Six Nations championship.
Yeah, it's a surprise, isn't it? Because they are gifted, and they have more depth. So I think he's under the pump now. I think if they were to go and win this championship, and if they were to lose to Ireland, I think he may fall on the sword. I think, and not necessarily the French Federation will get rid of him. I think he will take stock and go, look, I'm not getting the best out of this group. So huge game for them in Dublin.
Certainly is. And then just quickly on England as well, like fair play to them because they came in under a lot of pressure. A loss start would have been disastrous heading into a Calcutta Cup fixture, which they haven't won in quite a few years, and had to seriously dig their way out of it. A word in particular, Johnny, for Finn Smith, who just second half in particular went out and grabbed that game by the balls.
Yeah, he was very good. And like even his honesty post game in terms of kind of he admitted that he was a bit rattled and a bit rabbit in the headlights. And then he just, you know, he you know, his cross field, I know he has that connection with the winger in terms of they play together, but like he was really, really impressive. And like I know it was an easy kick, but like there's still a lot of pressure on him to get that at the end, you know, and manage the time, all of that. Yeah, I thought he was excellent. And again, it's something that Borthwick probably needs to settle on who is their first choice 10 and be a bit less horses for courses. But he was excellent. And yeah, it was a mixture of England probably having the balls to go and get the win, as well as France playing poorly, I think, was where the game from. But to be fair, England, they came from behind, and their attitude to go and grasp the game in the last 5 6 minutes was massive, and you have to tip your hat to them in terms of that. But I thought he was excellent for that young for a younger 10 under a lot of pressure. And like the English players of all the nations, like they get absolutely dogged out of it by the media. So like it is a very, very pressurized environment, regardless of how much they try. And you even see like Ellis Genge and Will Carling going at each other on Twitter. Like it does, and they have enough personality in the players in England that they do stand up for each other and stand up and take people on, which is good to see. But it does create it is funny to see it. But that's just the pressure that the media are and have on all English teams over there.
Yeah,
Just.
I did think of that. I couldn't possibly picture a scenario where like James Ryan is calling out your Irish journalists on Twitter or on Instagram. It's just so alien to us. You were about to say something there, Bernard?
No, I don't know if you saw how close he was to getting blocked down, Finn Smith, at the end, which would have been like the behind view was only maybe that like a foot. And in fairness to him, like what was going through his head there? He was trying to watch both clocks, the match clock, and then the kick clock. He knows he had scored. I think. You can see the benefit from having halfbacks to play together, for their club. So Alex Mitchell and him were very much on the same page. Finn Smith has a lot of talent, but I think he also brings a lot of structure. So England's attack looked better than it did with Marcus at 10, even though Marcus obviously is an incredibly gifted attacker. I thought the two halfbacks, sorry, the two playmakers worked well for them, particularly as France kicked along to them. England had Marcus coming back at France and getting them on the front foot. So it'd be really interesting. Is that now does Marcus go back to the bench, or does Marcus get the start at fullback every week? But I think Finn Smith could be the missing link to get actually England playing and bringing their flair players into the game, because they have them. Freeman is excellent. Ollie Lawrence is excellent. They have lots of depth there. Even Arundel is coming back now to bat next year. I know he's got flaws, but as an attacking player, he's phenomenal. So yeah, England, the Northampton axis may be the way forward for England.
Yeah, I think it's a good point on the kick as well, because he would have been absolutely slaughtered if England had made a mess that restart and lost the game. He would have been slaughtered for not running out the clock, which he just about would have had a couple of seconds to do. But I
That's
think
right.
it does actually speak to his character that he just said, no, stick the conversion over, stop worrying about the clock, and just execute the restart, which they went and did. That's where we'll leave it, fellas. We'll talk a little bit more about England against Scotland next week as well, because that's shaping up to be an absolute cracker narrative-wise, midway through the championship. Back to URC this weekend, Munster and Scarlets. That's the live game on RT2 and RT Player. So stay tuned for that. Johnny and Bernard, thanks a mil for joining us, and
Thanks,
we'll
Neil.
see you again soon.